You know, it's my great pleasure right now to introduce to everybody a man who really needs no introduction.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King.
Carl. I'm not calling the fans geeks. I'm not calling them rednecks, tobacco chewing nothing, because I've done all that myself.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King. Carl.
In your dreams, you will see me.
Excuse me, please, let's don't talk negatively.
I'm going to win the title. I'm going to keep my money and buy me some good old Tennessee drinking whiskey with it.
Thank you for being such a great husband.
And this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold, baby, just like you and me.
Hey, everybody. Carl here for whenitwascool.com, wrestlingobserver.com, figure4online.com. You know the drill by now. Thank you very much for listening. And I'm interrupting my usual rotation of classic wrestling audio shows. We have themed shows that we run in a rotation to kind of keep things interesting and mixed up. We do the long form history of wrestling series. We're up in 1983 right now. You can get all those back episodes going all the way back into the 1800s and even earlier over at whenitwascool.com. Click on the long form history of wrestling podcast page. We are, about 70-plus shows into that series now. We also periodically review pro wrestling shows, and I've got another one of those coming up soon. We do from the pages of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, which is where I talk about Dave Meltzer's biographies and obituaries. We do the greatest kayfabe tournament, the GKT, where we talk about, you know, fantasy book two legendary wrestlers against one another in a tournament format, and very popular, very, in my opinion, a great series that people, I think, are sleeping on a little bit. But you're talking about some very interesting history. The history of pro wrestling at Madison Square Garden. We're going through the history of pro wrestling at, you know, arguably the most famous arena in the world, Madison Square Garden in New York City. But I've broken that cycle here for a couple weeks, and we may even for a couple weeks more to come. I'm going to be posting a series on my free feed, which you can get on Apple iTunes, the When It Was Cool Dragon King Carl Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling podcast. It's a free podcast, and I'm going to be doing a series called A Through Z of Pro Wrestling History, and I needed to catch up on a few different letters. I had some shows that I was like, they're either kind of recent or I don't want to redo these shows, rerun them. So I've got a few different letters I need to fill in. And so I'm doing that with some biographies and at least one show that's not a biography that'll be coming up pretty soon. But for the letter O, which is where we are today, letter O, I've chosen One Man Gang. And again, you know, a few of these guys that I've chosen to do newer biographies on are, you know, kind of having a reputation of nice guys, good guys in wrestling business. Certainly, One Man Gang has that reputation. He was a great heel back in the territorial era of wrestling, back in the 1980s, of course. He had a good run in Texas World Class Wrestling. Most people remember him from the WWF and maybe even WCW later on. He had the regrettable gimmick of Akeem, the African Dream, for a while there in WWE, and we'll talk about that as well. But the subject of today's biography is George Gray. He is One Man Gang. He was born February 12th, 1960. He's still alive. He's only 62 years old. It's a kind of strange thing, but he was one of the younger guys back in the territorial days. I mean, he did most of his very successful stuff when he was a very young man. And you don't think about maybe, you know, One Man Gang out there in Texas because he was big and intimidating. He had the mohawk and the tattoos on the side of his head. And, you know, he was the big scary guy. But, yeah, he was pretty young when he did that stuff. So he was born February 12th, 1960. And he worked for a couple of years in the WWF as Akeem. The rest of the time he's been One Man Gang. I really enjoyed his work in the UWF, the Universal Wrestling Federation, the former Mid-South Wrestling. That's maybe my favorite era of One Man Gang. I'm not sure. Man, his world-class run was really something good, too. But he actually started out in the late 1970s. He was trained supposedly by a regional wrestler, really independent wrestler back then, a guy you may not have ever heard of, named Jerry Bragg. He wrestled as Chief J. Eagle in a lot of different places. Darren Westbrooks. These are not normally people that we, you know, hear that much about in the late 70s. In fact, I don't know that I've ever even heard of Darren Westbrooks before. I think I've seen some results of Chief J. Eagle, but, you know, it's hard to remember. There were so many Native American gimmicks back in the late 70s. Who knows, you know? But they were Carolina Independent or Outlaw Circuit is what they were called back then. And he broke in under both his real name and as Crusher Gray. He goes on they were an outlaw group too, ICW, the Poffos group. He broke in with them using the name Crusher Broomfield. So he's going with this, you know, early in his career, this Crusher nickname. Obviously, he's a tall guy. He's not just a your quote big fat guy, big obese wrestler, you know, type, which he certainly was that, but he was also very tall. He's usually listed being like 6'9" tall. I don't think that's anywhere close to accurate, but I would say he's probably north of 6'5". He's maybe in the 6'5", 6'6". He's a huge dude. He's a big, big guy. His weight's often billed around 450 pounds, and I imagine he's probably legit around at his, you know, at the peak of his wrestling career was probably around the 400-pound mark. So he's a big, big fellow. Crusher Broomfield, as Crusher Broomfield, rather, in ICW. You can still see some video of him from this time period. Of course, you know, your big stars then were Randy Savage, and Ron Garvin was in there at the time. So this was, you know, the Poffos ICW was not an inconsequential little outlaw promotion. They had some names in there, and of course they end up working a big angle and feud with Memphis. No, didn't start out as an angle. It certainly started out as a shoot and ended up as a working agreement with Memphis. But that's where early Crusher Broomfield was to be found. Now, you can't keep a big guy like that hidden in 1980s. Like he's going to get picked up by somebody, and he did. He worked a little bit with Mid-South Wrestling prior to their turn to the UWF. He really kind of bounced around a lot in his early years. He went to Florida, had a good little run down there in Florida, even feuded with Dusty Rhodes in 1983, really 1983 into 1984. Also worked with Blackjack Mulligan, Mike Rotundo, Ron Bass, you know, your bigger names down there. In fact, he and Ron Bass won the Florida tag team titles, beating Dusty Rhodes and Mike Davis in a weird kind of little angle they were doing there with Dusty Rhodes and Mike Davis. He held the belts with Ron Bass for a couple months before losing them to Mike Rotundo and Mike Davis. And yeah, Mike Davis is another guy I'd like to look kind of deeper into his career with, because I guess he's probably best known as one half of the Rock and Roll RPMs with Tommy Lane, but he had that whole Florida deal, which was really very interesting as well. And then later, late in his career with Global Wrestling Federation, you know, he's not a guy that you think of on a national level, but he's an interesting character. And I guess some of these biographies we're doing here are not necessarily the biggest stars of the time period, although we've covered many of those. If you go to our Patreon content page, you'll see our wrestling biographies we've done so far, and many of the biggest wrestlers of all time we've covered there. But I really like learning and about these little bit lesser known wrestlers. And the One Man Gang was certainly a pretty big star, but you know, he wasn't like a world heavyweight champion anywhere or anything like that, although he did get the U.S. championship in WCW at one point. November 1984, he's Panama Gang. So that's his first kind of maybe not the best idea for a gimmick. Back during that time, it was, I don't know if this was a regional thing or what, but the Panama Jack suntan lotion shirts became like a pop culture rage. And again, I don't know if this was all over the country, but certainly here in the Southeast, every kid in 1984 had to have a Panama Jack t-shirt. No idea why. It lasted maybe, you know, that fad lasted maybe 6 months. But I can remember in middle school, every kid had a Panama Jack t-shirt. So I guess he's kind of riding the wave of that very brief pop culture phenomenon there. He held one of his first championships down there, the Brass Knuckles Championship, beating Blackjack Mulligan for that championship, which that was those Brass Knuckles titles were usually kind of unofficial, sort of off-the-record kind of titles. And once he left the area, they just abandoned it. He goes to All Japan Pro Wrestling. Yes, One Man Gang had a little run in All Japan from during 1983 and 84, and he even went back again in 86. While there, he worked. I mean, the big guns over there, Giant Baba, Genichiro Tenryu, Jumbo Tsuruta. He even teamed with Bruiser Brody a few times over there. So, and Stan Hansen. So that's a big deal. He had brief cups of coffee in Central States and ends up in Texas for World Class Wrestling, World Class Championship Wrestling, Fritz Von Erich's promotion. And this is where he really gets on the national radar, so to speak. Now, you know, he's a name, mind you, from Florida. People now know who he is. But the magazines really picked up covering him. The Aftermags especially really picked up covering him nationally when he goes to World Class in 85. And he joins up with Skandar Akbar as part of Devastation Incorporated. And I bet many people this is probably their first memories of One Man Gang. It's certainly kind of mine. He shows up and he's, you know, he had previously had this long stringy hair. Now he's got it cut into a mohawk. He's got tattoos on the side of his head. That's, you know, interesting. He actually gets his mohawk while he's there, and there's kind of a story behind that as well, the story behind all that. He's brought in and put on top. I mean, he's feuding with the Von Erichs. And what happened with his hair is May 5th, 1985, he lost to Kerry Von Erich in a hair versus hair match. Like, Kerry Von Erich's going to lose his hair. I mean, it's, you know, a foregone conclusion who's winning that match. And that's when he starts wearing the mohawk. And he even gets tattoos on the side of his head, you know, I can't remember exactly what the tattoo is, but it has something to do with the Von Erich feud and his deal with Kerry at the time. I mean, that's dedication for sure. To be sure, that's like maybe not Bam Bam Bigelow level, you know, dedication to a gimmick, but still, that's something else. I was trying to find what exactly it said. I was trying to remember. Let me see here. I've got a picture. I got a photo of it here. Well, I guess it's off the internet now. Let me see here. Ah, man, I wish I could remember what that was, because it was like somehow tied to that. Gary Hart, I think, is the one maybe who first brought this up. Anyway, whatever the story is, maybe I'll run across it here. But it's a good deal. I mean, it's a good run there. He lost to Bruiser Brody in a chain match at the Christmas Star Wars show in 1985. So he had a little run with Bruiser Brody, even had some cage matches with him there leading into 1986, where he's going to transition then to Mid-South wrestling. And I really, really liked him in Mid-South, especially as it changes over to the UWF. I thought he was a real good fit there. You had like Terry Gordy, Steve Dr. Death Williams, Big Bubba Rogers. So, you know, he and Big Bubba Rogers, who's later a Big Boss Man in WWF, this is where they first kind of get associated with one another at. He came in as a protege of Skandar Akbar. He would ends up getting kind of the – I think it was actually Bill Watts that coined the One Man Gang name for him. And then he goes from Mid-South over to World Class, and I think that's how that worked, actually. So he had a quick stint there through Mid-South, and that's where, you know, Bill Watts comes up with One Man Gang. When he comes back in and it becomes UWF, he's put on top. I mean, he's a main event guy. And he's got this feud going with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and that's a real good matchup. I mean, that's a WWF-level matchup right there. I mean, these are two people who would be stars in WWF, obviously, and Jim Duggan was a gigantic star down in Mid-South UWF. You know, he was behind Junkyard Dog, maybe the second most popular guy ever there. I know a lot of people probably think Steve Dr. Death Williams, and maybe it's close, maybe even Ted DiBiase, but I think after second to Junkyard Dog, Jim Duggan was probably the most popular wrestler ever down there. So if you're feuding with him, you've got a good thing going. In late 1986, One Man Gang won the UWF Heavyweight Championship. Yeah, he became their world champion. Terry Gordy, who was the first champion, was injured earlier in the evening by Steve Dr. Death Williams and was scheduled to face One Man Gang later in the card, but he got hurt. And so Bill Watts, you know, he always had this thing that was very, you know, sports oriented. Why would they do this in football was, you know, basically how Bill Watts would, you know, book anything. And so he's like, well, you know, if a team didn't show up in football, they would lose. It would be a forfeit. And so that's what happened. And One Man Gang won the UWF world title by forfeit. Now, in wrestling terminology, that's probably not the best idea. I think it hurt the credibility of the title, but nevertheless, that's what happened. And he held it for 6 months. I mean, he held it for 6 months and worked with Jim Duggan a lot, Steve Dr. Death Williams, and Ted DiBiase. So he's, you know, he is the heel being chased by three of the biggest baby faces that were ever in the Mid-South UWF area. In May 1987, One Man Gang began receiving inquiries from the WWF about coming up to wrestle for them. And he's, you know, he's made perfectly for that. Of course, the Hulk Hogan Monster of the Month Club, you know, is bring in these big guys that Hulk Hogan can, you know, sell for and then come back and look, you know, triumphant. He's overcome the big monster. And that's what, you know, fast track One Man Gang up there. So One Man Gang drops the title to Big Bubba Rogers, who, you know, would be on his way up there in the not too distant future also as the Big Boss Man. And ultimately, it was a great move because very soon thereafter, Bill Watts sells to Jim Crockett Promotions, and that's pretty soon after that for UWF. And who knows how he would have done in WCW under the early, you know, in the early 1990s were not kind to WCW. And I'm not sure. I think he might have floundered there, but he certainly made the better choice, I think. So he makes his WWF debut May 12th. 1987. He's managed by Slick. I was never a big fan of Slick or the whole Slick gimmick or all that. And as it would turn out, it would lead to a really regrettable gimmick change for One Man Gang. But anyway, he makes his debut then, May 12th, 1987. He spent much of his early WWF run defeating, you know, just squashing people, basically. And he, you know, he's being worked up the card to face, you know, to be fed to Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage, who were the biggest baby faces of the time. One Man Gang was in the first ever Survivor Series pay-per-view as a member of Andre the Giant's team, fighting a team led by Hulk Hogan. So he's been programmed opposite of Hulk Hogan. 1988, he was in the first ever Royal Rumble, and he was one of the last two men left in the ring. A Royal Rumble won by... who else? Somebody he's very familiar with, Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Now, One Man Gang, after they do the deal where the title ends up vacant after the Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant Saturday Night main event angle. So the title's vacant. It's going to be up in a tournament at WrestleMania 4, and One Man Gang's in that world title tournament. And he beats Bam Bam Bigelow, who, you know, was going to be taking some time off because of a knee injury, but to the fans who you know, weren't smart fans, just the regular fans out there, Bam Bam Bigelow had been booked pretty strongly leading up to this. And most people, I would have thought, would have been under the impression that Bam Bam Bigelow was the favorite in this match. But so One Man Gang beating him, even though it was by countout, was a pretty good was a pretty good deal, but he drew a bye in the quarterfinals and was disqualified in the semifinal against Randy Savage. So he didn't really have a clear win in this tournament, and even his match against Randy Savage left a lot to be desired. And it really, I think, took a lot of momentum away from One Man Gang. And you would think with Randy Savage now being champion that, One Man Gang should be a great opponent for him. But One Man Gang gets kind of moved down the card. I mean, he ends up working, again, against Bigelow for a minute, but also, you know, guys like Don Morocco and Coco Ware even and people like that. So he's kind of floundering a little bit, and that's where we end up with the gimmick change to Akeem the African Dream, and this was a way of making fun of Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. There's no easy way to say this in 2022 sensibilities. Looking back at, 1988 WWF sensibilities, which were very poor. But what you had was Dusty Rhodes was considered, a guy who stole a lot of his gimmick and a lot of his act from African-American community, specifically Thunderbolt Patterson, his whole interview style and all this. And so he was always, and especially when Dusty Rhodes came to the WWF, they really played it up with Sapphire and all this, is that he was a white guy who, tried to appropriate African-American culture. And so to make fun of, Virgil Runnels, Dusty Rhodes for that, they decide to take, the big fat white guy they got at the time, One Man Gang, and make him Akeem the African Dream. And here is the angle they did that. You'll be hearing Mean Gene Okerlund. You'll be hearing Slick, and then you'll hear One Man Gang transition into Akeem. It's very, very hokey, but here you go.
This is Mean Gene Okerlund on special assignment with an update. Can't believe this place. I was supposed to meet the Doctor of Style, Slick, here tonight. He was going to take me to the deepest, darkest Africa. Now, this ain't it. He's got some big surprise, some new talent that'll be operating under his guidance. Second thought, this is deep, this is dark. Slick! Oh, I'm glad I found you, pal. I can't believe I'm starting to get scared here. I didn't know who I was going to run into.
Yo, brother!
What is it, cousin?
Now, hold. Listen, this may not be deep, dark Africa, but now you know the Slickster never disappoints. Now, I may not have carried you to Africa, but I'm going to bring Africa to you.
How so, Slick? How can you bring Africa to us?
Listen, brother, tonight, a startling transformation is about to take place.
A startling transformation?
Brother, it's going to be one that's going to rock the world of professional wrestling. It's going to shake it right off its very foundation.
Here on the World Wrestling Federation?
That's right. And guess what?
What? Your basic, is that a radio tape recorder? That's it.
Brother, it's time for it to start right now. Let the ceremony begin.
Oh, what is this? I was here all alone, and now, all of a sudden, I cannot believe this. Absolutely incredible. Call a lawyer. Get an out-of-court settlement on this. Maybe I'll re-up my subscription to National Geographic. Could be a PBS special. Slick, I demand some kind of an answer. What is happening here tonight?
Well, me, Gene, is just as simple as this, brother. I'm telling you that tonight there's going to be a transformation that's going to take place.
Wait a minute. You've been beating around the bush, Slick. What kind of a transformation? What are you talking about, man?
Man, I'm telling you, Holmes, it is going to shock the world of professional wrestling, and it's going to happen tonight.
Well, let's not keep everybody in suspense. Make it happen, Slick.
Behold! And behold, Akeem!
Akeem?
Team, wait a minute, Slick. Wait a minute. $430, $450. I recognize this band as the one man gang.
No, 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 no. This is a key. Don't you ever refer to him as the one man gang again.
Wait a minute, one man gang? You think I just got off the...
Then you hear me, thick-headed fool. From now on, I will be known as Akeem. I'm reborn tonight, the greatest night in history.
What? I didn't just get off the turnip truck. I know better.
Listen, man, calm down. Didn't you hear what the big man just said? This is the greatest night in wrestling history. I told you it was going to shock the world, a professional wrestler. And just look at him.
What plans do you have for this man, Akeem?
Akeem, brother, has been reborn. He's seen the light, and now he has a new intensity. He's gonna soar up to the top of the ladder.
Are you telling me, Slick, that the one man gang?
Why did you say me?
Beg your pardon. Akeem has been revitalized.
He's been revitalized, brother. Never before has he ever talked. He's a new man.
I'm a new man,
Mean Gene Okerlund.
See that?
You understand what's going down tonight? You don't really understand the impact this is going to have on professional wrestling, do you, brother?
I really don't. I don't know if I want to get into this.
It's time to go, bro.
Akeem and Slick are checking out. Oh, look at that. I'll tell you what. Incredible here. It's been what an exciting visit. Kind of a cool evening. And I want to especially thank these gracious people for allowing me in the neighborhood, so to speak. Thank you very much. We really appreciate it. What about the transformation of the one-man gang? Oh, Akeem, I beg your pardon. Hey, wait a minute. Guess who's not staying for dinner tonight? Thank you very much. Hey, somebody call me a cab. Get me a cab. Hey, call a cab.
But to be fair, you know, Akeem, One Man Gang, George Gray, got some mileage out of the gimmick. They team him up with Big Boss Man, the Twin Towers tag team, and that works very good. The two have good chemistry together. And they kind of stand out. I mean, you think back to that era, and you certainly remember the Twin Towers tag team. Now, strangely enough, they never held the WWF tag team titles. They did work with, the dominant tag team champions, one of the longest reigning WWF tag team champions ever, Demolition, Axe and Smash, who were, mass superstar Bill Eadie and his partner Barry Darsaw, who had been Crusher Khrushchev. And, and that worked. I mean, you got four big, heavy guys who are just pounding each other, and that just, they're big, strong guys, giants, and it works. It works, and it's a good middle to upper middle card feud during that whole time. In the fall of 1988, the Twin Towers and Slick advertising a title match that night against Demolition while on Arsenio Hall's talk show. Now imagine if you weren't around for Arsenio Hall back in the day. That was a very successful, very popular, very culturally relevant talk show. Arsenio Hall was, in today's world, I mean, whatever happened to Arsenio Hall, right? He was at one point in time a very, very successful, popular a TV talk show host, a comedian. And can you imagine, well, you don't have to imagine, you can look it up on YouTube or whatever, Akeem interacting with Arsenio Hall and just how utterly ridiculous that was. And it was, and it was stupid. It was just one of those embarrassing things that you always, even back then, and WWE never got over this and still does it this day. It's always one of those things. You're always afraid. If I have a friend watching this with me, I'm going to get embarrassed. There's a possibility of something embarrassing coming on. And, Akeem was certainly one of those, kind of roll your eyes, one of those things that gives wrestling the reputation it has often had, unfortunately. They were strongly involved in the storyline, which would eventually cause Randy Savage to become a heel and defend his title against Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 5. In the Royal Rumble, Randy Savage was accidentally eliminated by Hulk Hogan, allowing both Akeem and the Big Boss Man to double-team Hogan and eliminate him. The main event show, broadcast live on NBC on February 3rd, 1989, featured the Mega Powers versus the Twin Towers, a very famous match, very highly rated match, one that many fans of this era remember as maybe one of WWF's best ever angles. The Mega Powers meltdown, you know, and the Twin Towers, one man gang, Akeem, he's right in the middle of this. During the match, Randy Savage's, manager, I guess, whatever you want to call her, Miss Elizabeth, she was injured after Savage was thrown through the ropes and knocked her to the ground. This led Hogan, of course, to do the old damsel in distress, carrying her to the back, and he's, you know, overacting the help, call the ambulance, people, you know, kind of deal. Hogan later returned to the match, but during the whole time, Savage is getting beat up by Akeem and Big Boss Man. This led, of course, to Savage attacking Hogan backstage, which set up the big match for WrestleMania 5. That sort of leaves the Twin Towers kind of cut out of it, though, but they went on to face the Rockers at WrestleMania 5, which, you know, ended with Akeem pinning Shawn Michaels. I mean, yeah, one-man gang pinned Shawn Michaels. That's, you know, that was not as big a deal as it would have been a few years later, but at the same time, I mean, they got a, you know, big win at WrestleMania. In early 1990, Big Boss Man became upset with Slick, always trying to take credit for him. And he turned, you know, babyface, turned against both Slick and Akeem. He then defeated Akeem at WrestleMania 6. So a year later, the Twin Towers were split up and are having a match. And it's Big Boss Man getting the push, not Akeem. Akeem stayed in the WWF until October of 1990 and his loss to Big Boss Man was his last high-profile match with the company. It was pretty much the end of it for him there. And, you know, ends up fading out by October 1990. He was part of Sergeant Slaughter's team on the Survivor Series in 1990. But, I mean, that's, you know, we're talking about Orient Express is also a member of that team. So, you know, that was... That, or he was going to be, he ends up leaving. He's actually replaced by Boris Zukov. I mean, that's kind of where he's at on the chain of things. Where does he go next? Well, would you believe Memphis, USWA? Now, mind you, he only had one match in Memphis. That was December 28, 1990. He won a battle royal there. But WCW's, you know, they've got this free agent out there who's, you know, had a lot of exposure on WWF TV. So obviously they want to pick one man gang up. He's still a young guy at this point. And why not? So March 5th, 1991, he makes his debut once again as the one man gang. And he comes to the aid of Kevin Sullivan, someone who he had become acquainted with down in Florida. He attacks Ron Simmons following a squash win that Ron Simmons had just had. This is the crazy one man gang era. This is where now he's like messes his hair up. He's like drawing black circles around his eyes. He's acting like a, you know, no longer is he like the biker one man gang. You know, he's certainly not the pretending to be from Africa one man gang. He's now crazy. He's mentally unbalanced. And it's not the best look for one-man gang, unfortunately. And he ends up really being programmed with people lower down the card. You know, Ranger Ross, Brad Armstrong, Junkyard Dog, people like that. People who weren't in any danger of, you know, main eventing there in WCW during this time period. He made his first WCW pay-per-view appearance May 19th, 1991 at Super Brawl 1. He attacked El Gigante following El Gigante's match with Sid Vicious. And, yeah, that was something else. He does this angle with Kevin Sullivan where, you know, this has got Kevin Sullivan written all over it. This has got later Dungeon of Doom written all over it. Just bizarreness. His 1991 run in WCW is just weird, just very weird. Then this is a time period where you got people like Black Blood, who was Billy Jack Haynes with basically a stocking over his head. Big Josh, who's Matt Bourne, who's a lumberjack and one point in time walks bears down to the ring. You know, he's just in these weird deals. He was supposed to be in that Halloween Havoc 91 Chamber of Horrors match. Remember the one where Abdullah the Butcher got electrocuted? I reviewed that show. It's very, very popular in my series of shows. One of my most popular reviews I've ever done. But he got fired. Why did Jim Herd fire One Man Gang? Because One Man Gang refused to lose to the latest new fat guy they're pushing up the roster, PN News. So, yep. He's out. Now, One Man Gang's gone for a while. Now, I don't know what he did during his time. He ends up being like a prison guard or something, and maybe he first did that here during his time period, but he's actually leaves wrestling for a few years. He ultimately returns when he does come back to wrestling. It is to WCW in the fall of 1995. In fact, November 16th, 1995, he debuts on WCW Saturday Night in a squash match. He's in for that World War III pay-per-view, and he was one of the last people to be eliminated in one of the three rings. So he's, you know, getting a little bit, I guess, of a push that culminates actually at Starrcade 95, where he beats Kensuke Sasaki, the United States champion from New Japan Pro Wrestling, to win the title. And it's just, this was a weird, again, like a lot of his career, really weird thing. The match was restarted, and Kensuke Sasaki won the match, but he was never, like, on TV acknowledged as champion again. Like, One Man Gang remained the champion. It was just this crazy, kind of mixed up, messed up sort of deal. January 20th, 1996, he's there on WCW Saturday Night, defending the United States Championship, even though Kensuke Sasaki was actually the U.S. champion. There he is defending the title on Saturday Night against, of all people, you know who his opponent was. I'm going to be covering this guy in our biography series coming up. Super Giant Ninja. Yes, Super Giant Ninja. Now, if you're sitting there saying to yourself, huh? Yep. Well, Super Giant Ninja was none other than the Yeti. Yes. So that's, I guess, the answer to a weird world trivia question. Who was One Man Gang, who wasn't really WCW United States champion, but was? Who was his first opponent in a title defense? Yes, it was the Yeti, not the Yeti. The Yeti as a ninja, dressed up ironically as kind of a Power Ranger. We'll get to the Yeti. I'm going to be doing a biography on him, so stay tuned. If that doesn't get your Patreon support at whenitwascool.com, I don't know what do you want from me? Are you not entertained? Anyway, One Man Gang become a part of the early Kevin Sullivan Dungeon of Doom. On January 22nd, 1996, WCW Monday Nitro, One Man Gang lost to Hulk Hogan. The U.S. title, which he may or may not have held, was not on the line there. He joins the Dungeon of Doom and the Four Horsemen in attacking Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage. Then at Clash of Champions 32, One Man Gang, who I guess they've decided, I guess he's U.S. champion, he beats Disco Inferno. But there at the next set of TV tapings, he's going to lose the belt that he may or may not have held to, of all people, Conan. What a mismatch of styles that had to be. He soon thereafter left WCW and, you know, spends the rest of the late 1990s just periodically popping up in independent promotions. Texas Indies, even goes back to Japan for like FMW for a minute. Remember, and who can possibly forget the Heroes of Wrestling show, October 10th, 1999. that one may be my most popular review. Like, that's the one that I think's been downloaded probably more than any other show I've ever done, was my Heroes of Wrestling review, available at whenitwascool.com. One Man Gang wrestled Abdullah the Butcher in that match to a double countout. He even briefly showed up in ECW. Remember that? Yeah. November to Remember shows up and eventually ends up losing to the, quote, giant killer Spike Dudley. So he was basically set up to lose to Spike Dudley. And he left ECW in October of 99. He has been brought back a couple times to WWF for, like, these, you know, Legends deals. He was in that gimmick Battle Royal at WrestleMania 17, you know, that kind of deal. But that was pretty much, you know, he had basically gotten out of wrestling for the most part. He lost a lot of weight. I mean, that's one thing. When you look at One Man Gang at the, you know, nowadays versus then, while he's, you know, 62 years old, which is, again, younger than one would think, you can tell he's lost a lot of weight. His head's now completely shaved. He's actually expanded the tattoo on his side of his head. He looks really different. He's clean shaven. And so he doesn't look like really the One Man Gang you would remember. His post or outside of wrestling life, he actually had a career. He worked as a prison guard for Louisiana State Penitentiary. And he ended up having a heart attack in 2000, which also led to, you know, him losing a lot of weight. But he had a real downturn in his fortunes around 2016. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, there was a terrible, terrible flooding event in August 2016. It was the result of a hurricane or tropical storm. I can't remember. But anyway, it was a big, big deal. And he ended up losing a lot of his property, losing a lot of his stuff. And it's a very, very tragic situation for a guy, you know, that to lose a lot of his home and stuff. And after especially having health problems and everything, the website sportingnews.com, Alex Marvez, actually, I guess is why this got picked up. Alex Marvez wrote an article about it. It says, former WWE wrestler struggling after losing home in Baton Rouge flood. And there's a very sad picture of George Gray standing there. And you can tell he's you know, maybe put some weight back on. He looks not healthy. He looks depressed, to be quite frankly, and as he probably had every right to, as he stands there by basically the inside of his house gutted because of this flood. And Marvez writes the article, says that 6'6" and 400 pounds, George Gray never had problem taking care of himself in a pro wrestling ring. But even a performer who terrorized opponents as the One Man Gang can admit he needs some help from others after the torrential rainfall that flooded Baton Rouge. Gray and his family had the interior of their house in nearby Central City, Louisiana, destroyed last month when the Comite River overflowed into their property. To make matters worse, Gray was among the estimated 125,000 homeowners affected who hadn't purchased insurance to cover the damage because he wasn't living in a designated flood zone. This caught us by surprise because our place had never actually flooded in the 20 years we've owned the house, Gray told SportingNews.com during a Wednesday telephone interview. When you look curbside now, it's like a disaster zone. There's a giant mountain of our stuff in the front on one side of the house and a giant mountain on the other with things like a refrigerator, washing machine, and dryer that got ruined from basically sitting in 3 feet of water. Basically, everything is gone. All of my wrestling memorabilia was washed away. Things like old school posters and my boots that we didn't store in the attic because we didn't think it was ever going to flood. Gray is now relegated to temporarily living in a quality inn with his wife and their 8 rescue cats. They hope to soon move into a friend's trailer until their house can be repaired. The problem now is finding a way to pay for such work. Gray was recently given an estimated bill of $70,000 to $75,000 just to make his dwelling inhabitable. That's so sad. That prospective cost has placed the 56-year-old Gray in rough financial predicament. His wrestling days are long behind him. Gray has a chronic back issue that forced him to quit his post-grappling job as a Louisiana penitentiary guard several years ago. Gray, who suffered a heart attack in 2000, also is one of 53 pro wrestlers who have filed a class-action lawsuit against WWE, claiming the company didn't offer adequate protection against head trauma in scripted matches that has led to long-term neurological damage. "There's no way to live in it," Gray said of his abode. "We have electricity, but basically nothing else. All the flooring is gone, the wood is stripped, the whole house is gutted." Gray then started to laugh, having accepted the reality that doing so is better than expressing self-pity about a situation. "It's just the way it is," he said. "It's a bad situation, but what can you do about it? There's no use crying or placing any blame on anyone else. It's an act of nature." This type of attitude and perspective served Gray well as he ascended the ranks in pro wrestling, where backstage politics would often dictate who would get, quote, pushed during his 1980s heyday. And then, Alex goes through, basically the highlights of his career, which we've, of course, talked about. Gray says, "I never considered myself a top main eventer. I was a utility man. If you needed me to do the opening match, that was fine, but I wasn't a Road Warriors type of name. I was lucky to break in the business early when there were enough wrestling territories to make a living. Going to WWE wasn't that big to me at all. My heroes were all guys I grew up watching, like Andre the Giant, Dusty Rhodes, and Blackjack Mulligan, to name a few. I just happened to be another name in the business." Gray jokes that his under-the-radar persona became evident whenever he traveled from city to city with the WWF troupe on a touring schedule, far more intensive than what the company stages today. Gray said that only three WWE performers were given first-class airline tickets: Andre the Giant, whomever was world champion at the time, and Ted DiBiase to help him perpetuate his wrestling gimmick as the Million Dollar Man. Everybody else used to try to get up there by wrangling their way around it. "I never had that luck." Jake Roberts would say, "I'm Jake the Snake Roberts," and the airline would say, "Well, we've got a seat for you." I'd say, "I'm Akeem the African Dream, and I got a seat way in the back." Outside of his former WWE manager, Ken Slick Johnson, Gray said he doesn't keep in touch with too many of the performers from his generation. While his in-ring days are over, Gray does still work wrestling conventions and meet and greets with fans. Gray and his wife, Mary, were at one of those events in Georgia the weekend that Baton Rouge flooding began. Gray said he was initially incredulous as their son, Justin, sent him pictures of the water gradually rising in their front yard. "I told my wife that if I had $1 million, I would have bet there would be no problems." When the water came up to the front door, Justin began putting down towels and blankets, trying to stop it. But he said it came up so fast, not even sandbags were going to help. As the house was being deluged, Justin Gray worked to save his parents' collection of cats, two rescued dogs, and a bearded lizard while wading in waist-deep water. All of them were boarded onto a rescue boat and taken to higher ground. Gray and his wife left the wrestling convention later that night, but were unable to access their home for several days until the water subsided. "It was horrible," Gray said. "I'd see flooding on TV, but it's different seeing it in person, especially your own house. Our freezer was upside down. The washing machine was tipped over. The doors were off the hinges from the current. There was mud. You could see water levels at the windows where all the garbage floated in." They ended up setting up a GoFundMe. And I don't know how well that did. I hope it did well for him. Very sad story there for One Man Gang. I hope his life is sufficiently recovered since then, because he was more than just a utility wrestler. I mean, he was a pretty big name. No, he was never world heavyweight champion. I guess in UWF he was, but in the major promotions, he was never the world heavyweight champion. But hey, when you're in the ring in WWF against Hulk Hogan, that's a pretty big deal. You've made your mark. You've did pretty good. And his story really is one of those that pisses me off about wrestling. When you've got a billion-dollar company like WWF and an insensitive asshole like Vince McMahon who could easily give these guys insurance, could easily give them a pension. He could give them a pension comparable to any professional sport. Would he just do it? And, you know, guys like One Man Gang and many others. I mean, he's just this example. You know, once they're done, they're done. And there's no residual benefits to amount to anything. Yeah, maybe he gets some videotape royalties here and there that amounts to pennies. You know, maybe some merchandising. So, although I couldn't tell you the last time I saw a One Man Gang or a Keem action figure or something. I think that Mattel's probably made some, but I don't know really, you know, what the financial benefit to him personally would be. I imagine there would be probably a contract of some sort, and maybe it's better than I'm anticipating it probably is. But yeah, you know, it's he highlights the working class portion of pro wrestling, you know, that really has never been taken care of adequately. So, you know, respect to One Man Gang, respect to George Gray and all those like him. He did get a little bit of hardware throughout his wrestling career. Again, down in Florida, he was the Brass Knucks champion and the Florida version of the U.S. Tag Team Champions one time with Ron Bass. Mid-Atlantic area, he was Mid-Atlantic Tag Team Champion once with Kelly Kaniski. He was UWF World Champion one time, United States Champion in WCW one time in World Class Wrestling. He held the co-held the six-man tag team championship with Killer Tim Brooks and Mark Lewin down in Puerto Rico for World Wrestling Council. He was their hardcore champion twice. And in the WWF, well, he won a Slammy Award, I guess, for whatever that's worth. Respect to One Man Gang, man. That's a working class guy. Those working class utility wrestlers, I guess what he called himself. I think he was a little more than that. But anyway, that's the story of One Man Gang. And that's our letter O for this series, A through Z of pro wrestling history. Hope you've enjoyed this. I hope you made you at least think, maybe educated you a little bit. And we will continue our series. Come on over to visit us at whenitwascool.com. Hope you'll bookmark that website. Hope you'll, you know, save the little mobile link to your phone or whatever, and come visit us. We put up a podcast almost every single day. Many of them are free. So come over and give us a try. Become part of our family over there. And hey, after you start listening to several of our shows and thinking, man, you know, there's two or three free shows a week, several Patreon shows a week. You know, hey, maybe I can afford $1 for a month's worth of access, get several hundred podcasts. And hey, if you come in at the $5 level, you're going to get almost 2,000 immediate access to almost 2,000. You can, of course, cancel at any time. But I think if you come over and give us a try, you'll really like what you see. WhenItWasCool.com. I'm Carl. Thank you very much for listening. And I'll see you here again soon with another show.
WhenItWasCool.com is your source for the best in retro pop culture. When It Was Cool features articles and podcasts on retro TV and movies, toys, action figures, pro wrestling, food, video games, and more. Hit the Patreon button to support us and get instant access to hundreds of premium podcasts and features. Family friendly and fun. WhenItWasCool.com.